Naturally Speaking.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Naturally Speaking podcast. My name is James Buckley, and in this episode I'm joined by a selection of colleagues from the University of Glasgow to discuss gender bias and equality in science, technology, engineering and maths subjects. First we're going to look a bit at whether women are underrepresented within the research community. Then we'll begin to explore some of the reasons why this might be, and also potentially what the solutions are to reverse this bias. Before we begin, I should of course introduce the people around the microphone with me. Co-chairing with me today is a PhD student.
Hi, I'm Hannah Truby, and I'm a PhD student studying here at the Institute for Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine.
Good, you got the name out, good. And you've got four other members of staff as well, so I'll first introduce themselves.
My name's Dan Hayden, I'm the Director of the Institute and Professor of Population Ecology and Epidemiology.
I'm Michelle Bellingham, I'm a lecturer in the Institute.
I'm Winnie Bonner, I'm a research associate here at the Institute.
I'm Richard Owen, and I'm a research associate at the Institute as well.
So thank you all for participating in this podcast. I think the best thing to do is start with a very obvious question. Is there actually a problem with gender equality in the science subjects? Michelle, you said you had a few facts and figures to entice us and tell us a bit more about
quite
this.
Quite interestingly, when you actually delve into it and have a look at the statistics. In the UK, girls actually outperform boys up to GCSE level. But after this, the further you go, fewer women you tend to find pursuing STEM subjects. Another interesting fact is, again, if you look at the subject of engineering, women make up 12% of engineering students at universities in the UK, and just 4% of those taking engineering apprenticeships.
We'll come back to a bit about why shortly, but I think an interesting point to make is, does this inequality matter? Dan, I think you had a few points about why this matters.
I think I'll put my institutional hat on at this point and say that I think it matters in sort of at least three ways. The first is that you obviously can't run an institution with any kind of discriminatory background. You want an equal, you want an environment that provides equal opportunities for everyone, and that's just basic. But from the role of a research institute, I think it's also a very important issue, because I'm a strong believer in the fact that there's many different ways to do research. There's a strong link between the different approaches people take to research and teaching and personality, and very important that you have an environment in which different personalities are equally supported and are able to prosper.
Because there's no one person that is optimal for doing science.
I think one of the big dangers we have is that we accidentally end up selecting for people who are somewhat similar in certain ways, because we have metrics for promoting people and we have metrics by which we judge success. You know, that does run the risk that you end up with one particular type of person, whatever that happens to be, and that's just a huge opportunity loss. I mean, the richest research environments undoubtedly arise from the sort of rich mixture of human personality, and that's absolutely fundamental. So, I think that matters both, particularly in an institute like ours, where interdisciplinary research plays such a major role. We need all kinds of people, and even if you don't correlate that with gender, and it's still really, really important that we're small, and everyone, every sort of personality type just needs to be supported.
But does anyone have any other points to make about the bias itself?
Well, I mean, Michelle mentioned that there's a very small percentage of females that go into engineering, and overall in STEM subjects there are less females, but there is, it depends what branch you go into. Like, for instance, medicine, veterinary and normal medicine is heavily dominated by female students, so it's not that women are not particularly interested in science, but it's maybe what type of science that they're interested in. And biological science as well, there's probably about 60% of undergraduate students are female. So I think it's at what point in maybe education that females are being attracted to different types of science.
I suppose we're very much getting on to the why, and why are women underrepresented in many of the science subjects. Not all of them, but many of them. We're saying, when does bias exist? For example, in the biological sciences, maybe many of us on the table are biologists. You said that there are many female undergraduate students, but then where does the bias actually start to appear?
I think this is something that, again, like when you were saying, it varies with different subjects. So you mentioned that maybe with something like physics or engineering, traditionally the bias is actually before they get to uni.
Okay.
There's a very strong feeling that biology is maybe the girl's way into science and maths is something that maybe the male mind is somehow better at. And this has been something that's been going for a while now.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you're looking specifically at biology, you've got a nice high level of women or an even level of women going into the courses. But as you go through academia, maybe you'll see more of a drop.
So it's these two stages, really. So at the early stage, why are certain subjects not taken up by young female students?
I think a lot of it does go back to role models as well. In education, from nursery, primary, all the way through, is heavily dominated by females. And, I think, you do sort of set ideas in young people's minds then at that point, or maybe even just having more male primary school teachers might bring a different aspect of science or engineering or into a teaching environment. I think they are laid down quite early.
So be maybe lack of role models. And
I think that does play a part.
And probably they're quite biased views generally in the media and world around us
well.
Yeah. I think there are a lot of.
No,
go on,
no.
Richard. You can have a go.
Well, I was just going to say that there's a lot of different views, and no one quite knows why. But one of them is that subjects such as physics and maths are kind of seen as geeky,
mm-hmm.
sort of male geeky subjects. I mean, that's one of the kind of stereotypes that kind of puts people off kind of doing them. So I think that comes in at the A-level when children kind of sort of have their first choice of what subjects they're going to do. So I think the predominant ones for girls are biology, English, and psychology. This is from the article I was reading with boys. It's physics, maths, and economics, the ones with the kind of highest skews.
Some extraordinary data from the Royal Society just released historical results on the University Research Fellowship Awards.
Just to let people know, these are the award, quite large amounts of money given to young researchers to allow them to establish a career in science.
Yes, they're sort of the bluest chip 5-year fellowships. They're made to young people, so if we're looking for looking to a solution to this problem, we'd like to think we'd seen it in this data. In 2010, 33% of awarded fellowships were to women. Fell to 22.5% in 2011.
Worse.
To 19% in 2012, to 17% in 2013. And this year, only 4.6% of these fellowships were awarded to women.
That's appalling.
And just for reference, I mean, the percentage of applicants was 20%. It was low, but it's a lot higher than 4.6%, which is those that were awarded.
They have already said that they're looking into it straight away, though.
So they're aware of
why this year's was only 5% and trying to understand what's going on.
I mean, they've taken the Sir Henry Dale fellowships out of this, and they are more biomedical, and in biomedical science,
mm-hmm.
women are better represented. It says in the footnote, although they're better represented, women still only account for 28% of those awards. So, even
mm-hmm.
where you expect to see better representation from women, we're still running at a very, very poor percentage. Probably worth saying, as a backdrop to that, just where we stand ourselves as an institute, as 67% of our PGT students are female. Last year this was.
That's postgraduate taught
courses,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
At PhD level, it's exactly 50-50 currently in the Institute. And then at grade 6, that's starting out lecturing, it's 64%. At the next lecturer level up, it's 61%. And then...
So this is 64%. Women.
Women, yes.
That's
and and then at grade 9, which is senior lecturer or reader, it's 55%. And at professorial level, it dips under 50% for the first time at 37%. So we have 16 professors in the Institute, 6 of whom are women.
It's therefore quite interesting to work out why women are being underrepresented, particularly at the higher sort of levels of the hierarchy within universities. Does anyone has anyone got any thoughts about or seen any particular evidence as to why that might be?
They call it the leaky pipe, I think. It comes partly from women leaving the subject, various and normally earlier stages of their careers, but also that women consistently seem to seek promotion later in their careers. So it's very noticeable, sitting on promotion committees, that the cases we get for promotion from women are always much stronger than the cases we get from men, with correspondingly higher success rates, because the women are waiting arguably 2 years too late, and the men are going for it arguably 2 years too early.
So is it just at the level of the professor that this bias continues to persist, or is it also present at earlier career stages too?
Well, at senior levels, definitely yes. I mean, obviously with the figures we have for professorial ratios in STEM subjects in, say, Russell Group universities, we're not going to get as many professorial applicants because there's a much smaller pool of women professors in the market there. So at that level, absolutely yes. I mean, what's interesting is when you see discrepancies between the ratios of, you know, women in potential pool and applying, selecting and being appointed, and you know, often you see those numbers diminishing as well. And that would imply that there's something going on in the selection process, which is reflected in those Royal Society figures.
There have been a few I remember there's an interesting paper once in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that looked at giving, I think, two different applications.
I read the same article, Jane.
One of which had a male Jane name, one of the male name on top, and one of the female name. What were the names?
Jennifer and John. Yes.
Okay. Do you want to explain a bit more about this, Richard? This is quite an interesting point with regards to the job applications.
So they had identical CVs, but with a different name at the top. So one was John, one was Jennifer, and then they asked various kind of lecturers to rank candidates. So I don't think it was just Jennifer and John. I think there might have been loads of different kind of applicants, but they all had, you know, the same CV with just different names on.
That's good. I thought for a second, if it's just two names, one male, one female, that would not be good scientific design.
I think it was more than one.
Okay.
So they gave it to, I think, 127 faculty members, it says, and they asked them to rank candidates and rank them in terms of their competence, what they reckon their starting salary should be, and also their willingness to mentor them. And what they found was that Jennifer was consistently ranked lower than John, even though they're exactly the same, and she was on $4,000 lower starting salary, and that people were much less willing to mentor her.
It's crazy.
But apparently, but she was found to be more likeable from just a piece of paper.
One positive. There
and
we
was
go.
That different for male or and female?
Oh, no, that's the key point. So the 127 faculty members were, you know, 50% male, 50% female. And both male and female faculty members were equally biased on the ranking of Jennifer and John.
That is interesting.
So, and I think when you look at lots of different studies, it always comes down to sort of that, where, for example, if you take the Research Council fellowships, the people on the committee are both male and female, so it's not like a committee of men that are not giving fellowships to.
They're quite balanced.
They are quite balanced, kind of male female, so it's not that sort of issue.
One thing you haven't mentioned at all is the idea of family. This is often suggested as having a major impact on women's decision to carry on in a career such a science, which can be quite sort of unpredictable, quite short-term contracts, and yes, not exactly easy and social working hours. Would anyone like to comment on perhaps having a family and doing science and the problems that might be associated with it? Willie, do you want to mention it?
I have to say that, speaking from someone who has three children, that I've always enjoyed working in academia because it gives you the flexibility that a lot of other professions don't. And yeah, perhaps you might have to work at weekends sometimes or come in late. But the reverse of that is that, you know, I might have to leave early one time to go and visit the school. And then I can, because I can work a bit later. I can, you know, design my own workload or working time to fit in around certain things.
So the flexibility.
The flexibility is great.
If you're not given that flexibility,
yeah,
things would become
difficult.
Would be very difficult.
I mean, the only other thing is one time I worked 4 days a week, but then I did find it hard to change your workload, you know, in my own mind, and that's my own fault, and maybe that is the demands on being a scientist, that, you know, it wasn't. I reduced my workload by 20%, and in effect, all I ended up doing was working from 7 a.m. until 5 a.m. 4 days a week, and maybe occasionally coming in at weekends. So But I felt that, I mean, that was my own, it wasn't that my PI was demanding that I, you know, did the same amount of work, you know, so, but I think, you know, with new mentoring schemes, etc. in place, that would be different, you know, if you were now working on an 80% job, then you would do 80% of what you were expected to do, you know, not 100%, but 80% of the time, so.
Do you think there's a pressure more on women, though, with regards to having a family than men?
It tends to be, women in this country at least, tend to be the primary carers, so in that respect. And I guess that time of when you're starting a family and your children need you the most tends to overlap quite significantly with the time when your career's just starting to take off and when some people would be pushing that.
In academia, for women, it's difficult to decide when is the right time to have a family because obviously, you know, do you wait or do you family sooner, and how does that tie in with, say, research if you've got field work and things like that? So actually the logistics of, you know, a mother and possibly your academic research can be quite difficult just logistically, but also, I mean, the realistically you are having some time out and that's going to have an impact on, say, publications, and there's no, you know, getting away from that. That happens. So maybe just being a bit aware and letting people know, you know, if you apply for a fellowship and you've had two career breaks, you know, the panel need to know these kind of things, and it's not something that you should hide from panels.
How negatively do you feel that people look on career breaks when you're applying for a job? Women who've had families will have career breaks. Is that something that
I don't
is an issue?
I wouldn't say so, but then
that's great.
I think, as what Michelle says, as long as it's made clear, yeah. So I think if, you know, if you have a CV, there's nothing wrong with saying between such and such a date that you had, you know, you had a career break, rather than just skipping
yeah,
over
yeah.
it. I think
it's absolutely essential.
You have to say, well, what were you doing with that time? And
so it's about increasing awareness of the
yeah.
positions you've been in and perhaps the difficulties you might have faced, and people actually also taking that into account.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it's the case, I think, that actually people inevitably work harder than that. I mean, if they're working 80%, they're doing more than 80%. If they're going half-time, they're more than half-time. So often their record, you know, yes, you're right, there will be an impact on the record, but it's not in proportion.
I imagine the more restricted your time is, the more, you know, time limits you have, then the better you work, the more efficiently and effectively you work.
But I've noticed this a lot, I think, in the Institute, is that when you are under time pressure, you start to spend your time differently. And that's, I mean, yes, it's more efficient, but actually what that means is you're more cut off from the rest of your colleagues, you're more focused, you probably spend less time socialising and networking and enjoying, possibly. You lose the more enjoyable aspects of the job and you feel more isolated. And at a time when you're probably under pressure and feeling like you're not performing in the way that you're used to performing, and that's a demoralising process as well. So I think it isn't just that this sort of physical demands and inevitable reductions in your productivity. I suspect that there's a big mental psychological impact as well from the change in the way that you work.
That seems a really good point in which to look at perhaps a more positive side of things as to what can be done to change this bias and this underrepresentation of women. And an interesting point to make at this stage is that all the academics around this microphone at the moment are members of the self-assessment team for our institute, the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine. And this self-assessment team looks at gender inequality in our institute and looks at, I think, ways in which that can be improved. I'm not explaining it particularly well, but I think Michelle might be able to better explain the self-assessment and also the broader charter that it's part of.
People that don't know, the self-assessment team is part of the Athena Swan Charter. And a lot of people have maybe heard about Athena Swan and thought it's a woman's name, what has she got to do with gender inequality? But actually, Athena Swan Charter evolved from work between the Athena Project and the Scientific Women's Academic Network, that's where the Swan part comes in, to advance the representation of women in science, technology, engineering, medicine and maths, so these STEM subjects. So for the self-assessment team that we're part of, we put together an application to become part of this has been a Swan Charter, so we are committed to promoting women's academic and scientific careers within our institute.
So this is a UK-wide university thing.
University and research institutes can apply for these awards too. So if you apply for an award and you become an Athena Swan member, you're effectively signing up to the following principles of the Charter, which are to address gender inequalities, to tackle the unequal representation of women in science by changing cultures and attitudes across the organisation, also look at the absence of diversity at management and policy-making level, looking at the high loss rate of women in science as an urgent concern. So you sign up to this Charter and you're committed to it if you are an institute like us that apply for it. And we've actually received our bronze Athena Swan Award.
Now, this is also particularly important now for getting research funding, I believe. And the government, there's pressure from the government as well to sign up to this Charter and make advances. Is that the case, Dan?
It's coming. It's definitely coming, and it's coming faster in probably biomedical research than in other areas, but there's no doubt that it is coming. But as it becomes more the norm to have this sort of accreditation, you become increasingly conspicuous when you don't. So there is a fair amount of pressure, and actually this has been going on for quite a long time. I think the first Athena Swan Awards were given out in 2006. We're quite far down this process, and it's interesting some universities are coming into this quite late.
So you said that this institute has a bronze award, Athena Swan Bronze Award. What does that mean? What had to be done to get that bronze award?
So to obtain a departmental bronze award, I mean to recognise that you've got a solid foundation for eliminating discrimination and developing an inclusive culture that values all staff. So you begin to look at your department and identify the statistics, how many postgraduate students you've got, how many academic members of staff you've got at different levels and genders as well. So
identifying where the biases start to appear in your
institute. If there is any biases and what can possibly be done about tackling those biases. It may be that for department or institutes actually quite equal. That doesn't mean to say that you don't have to put anything into practice or tackle anything. It means that you can still look at ways of promoting and how you can change things.
Do you think that makes it a bit more difficult? Because obviously if you're starting from quite a high starting point, then it's quite challenging to make those changes and to show that you've improved things.
Well, I was surprised. I came into this process, this application, aware of the figures, ratios across the different grades, and thinking that there wasn't much to be done here. And actually, I was surprised what we found out, partly through talking to people and partly through the staff survey.
So what sort of issues cropped up that you didn't expect?
Well, I would say that, I think this is an exhaustingly social institution. It's great, but I think it's shattering. but then it turns out, of course, that a significant number of people don't participate in that at all for all kinds of reasons, because they don't want to, or they can't, or they don't feel comfortable. And so you need to try to diversify the opportunities for those interactions in whatever way you can. It doesn't mean it's not for everyone, but you just need to make sure that you're playing as many different sort of, creating as many social opportunities and networking opportunities. I hate networking, it's a ghastly phrase. But it does mean that you're engaged in your work. I was also surprised to learn about just how significant the promotion issues were. We were far too dependent on people promoting themselves, putting themselves into the promotion process.
So there's no sort of mentoring to suggest to people that you're at a good stage.
The people who wanted mentoring could, of course, go out and get it and got it. But it was the people who didn't. It's the people who weren't comfortable going out and even seeking mentoring, who, of course, probably needed and wanted it, but didn't do it. And there was a significant, an important number of cases like this.
So there are you can quite easily set up these mentoring opportunities.
We have mentoring. We now have reform mentoring schemes within the institute, but also within the college, and I believe actually the university as well. So there's a sort of hierarchy of mentoring schemes that you can buy into depending on what sort of advice you're looking for. Promotion is a difficult one because it's traditionally been sort of veiled in, I think, in a completely unnecessary shroud of secrecy. And people are a bit uncomfortable about promotion because sometimes they don't want to look like they're ambitious, sometimes they don't want to be ambitious and then be seen to fail. And all of this creates this makes it a shadowy process. I'm quite keen to just, you know, let's get this out into the open. Let's learn. Find promotion's a good thing. It's career advancement. It's something to celebrate. Of course, you should make your, get your timing right, as right as you can, but it won't always be successful, of course, and that's perfectly fine. That's not a failure. So managing how we draw that out in a sensible way, and creating more space in the week, throughout and at the ends of the weeks, you know, when people can get together. I mean,
yeah.
You know, we'll end up in the pub, as we all know, most of us. but yeah, that doesn't work for everyone, and
yes,
the reason why it should. And
they may not spend time with us in the pub.
They might not want to be with us in the pub. But yeah, and we have had other opportunities, but we have more, we need more of them, I think. And you know, the idea of sort of meeting before seminars and every 2 weeks.
Tea, coffee, cakes every so often. These sort of events can be quite nice to sort of bring in a broad range of people. And I agree that these activities do help you meet and talk to people that you wouldn't normally chat to.
Break up the patterns. You know,
yeah.
The same people do the same things. So if that isn't what you want, you need to create something new. So create something new, you'll draw in more people.
So actually, what you could sort of see is that a lot of these sort of changes in solutions are actually not specifically geared at increasing representation of women, but it's probably just allowing, again, this greater diversity of personalities and people to work together within an institute. Is that right? It's not just about the gender. It's about
very interesting. Michelle and I were down in Durham to pick up the Bronze Award, and there was quite a lot of rather guffy speeches about I think that's one process, but there was one particularly impressive one from the head of department at York, who received a gold award, and she explained that it was their philosophy that poor working practices discriminate disproportionately against women, good practices benefit everyone. And in fact, she said that in her action plan, there wasn't a single gender-specific action. It was all about good practice. And she said not only did she feel that was the most effective way to proceed, it also became much more inclusive. People become sensitive if they feel they're being excluded from events. And the idea of just improving your practice across the board, I think it's actually a pretty sound one.
And there is ways of, I think Dan had said the word inclusive, and that's the whole part of the Athena Sorn Charter for males and females. But even through the sort of process of our Athena Sorn application and getting our Bronze Award and things that we're going to take forward to our Silver Award, we as an institute set up a group for female researchers that could just discuss socially certain aspects, you know, an environment where people could ask questions to maybe more senior staff.
So getting people talking to different people at different stages is really useful.
Exactly.
So one issue we haven't touched on is that of childcare. Winnie, I think you had a few interesting facts about childcare within this university versus other universities, but also more broadly across the UK.
The university does have a nursery, but the numbers that it can take are really quite small. I think it only has 74 places, and that's from babies up to age 5, which really is not sufficient at all. I mean, I know of people who had to delay coming back to work because they couldn't get a nursery place, and nowhere near our university.
And that does impact upon whether you feel inclined to come into work or not come
exactly,
into work, or take more time off.
Some people might like to have their childcare on site, and it's easy then to drop off, pick up, etc. like that. And I was just reading, in comparison to Glasgow, Oxford University has 429 childcare places across 12 sites and 4 college nurseries on top of that. And it's not that Oxford have a huge number more staff. Yes, they do, but Glasgow employs about 6,000, and Oxford has about 11,800. So there's still a huge disparity of ratios there. And they also, interestingly, I found out they offer a salary sacrifice scheme, so childcare is horrendously expensive, as anyone here who has children knows. And so because they run these nurseries, you can actually pay for them, as a salary sacrifice or before tax and insurance. So that's quite a big saving. The government does, through the university, you can buy childcare vouchers, but it's only It's only £240 a month.
It doesn't matter if you've got more than one child, you still get the same amount. So
it's really
once you go over one child, childcare is just crazy.
So it's quite limited, and perhaps it's the role of the university to do more, is it?
I think it is more, definitely. I think institutions have to take on responsibility now to making it more sort of family-friendly work policies, and that is one area that they could actually could make a big difference in.
Just interestingly, Dan, do you know what input can you have as a director of an institute into funding into childcare? Can you have anything at all?
Somewhat limited, but I mean, I can join with other managers at my level, within the college, to push these things up the chain. To be honest, I don't think that's happening as much as it should be. And it's important to point out that the university policies in this area are most of them are made centrally. So in fact, there's actually rather little the institute can do on its own. But we can obviously demonstrate what can be done by doing this well.
And we mentioned earlier that one of the potential reasons that we might be leaking from this pipe is because of this issue of the prime time for family conflicting with the time when you could be focusing on your career, and presumably provision of childcare is one way of to some extent mitigating this and making it easier for women and men to have families and to care for their families as well as working.
That's a good point. I think a nice link in there to maternity leave. I think it's only fairly recently that men have been increasingly allowed to take paternity leave, isn't it?
I think they've always been allowed, but the amount of time that they're allowed, previously 2 weeks, I think, was the kind of norm.
For paternity leave.
Yeah, 1 week, 90% pay, and then 1 week statutory pay, I think it was, yeah.
And how much was maternity leave?
I think for maternity you can take up to the 52 weeks off. So obviously not all of that's fully paid. There's certain universities get different streams that you can choose for maternity, but certainly way more. But now with the new legislation that's come in, there's a way in which the parents can share maternity and paternity leave as well. So
that seems a really good place in which to sort of ask the question, after the Bronze Award, the Athena Swan Bronze Award, what comes next? Michelle, I think you were...
Yeah, well, you would possibly maybe assume that once you've got a Bronze Award, you could maybe rest in your laurels and not worry too much about it because you're already tackling some of the issues that might be apparent in your institute. But the whole Athena Swan Charter is not just stopping at the minimum, is to actually take things forward and actually look at your action plan that you've created from your Bronze Award and go towards the Silver Award, which will then recognise a significant record of activity and achievement by the Institute in promoting this equality and addressing some of the challenges which they've found across the Institute.
So you do have to, you do have to show action and improvement to get these awards.
Yes.
It's not just a box-ticking exercise by the government.
These awards, although they may now be more competitive and more people applying because of the drive from, say, funding bodies looking to see that institutes have an Athena Swan recognition award. It's not simply a case of putting your application in and then not doing anything. You really must commit to the Athena Swan Charter fully.
Before we end, does someone want to make a final comment about why this is so important and why it shouldn't be as hard as it is?
Well, I'd say that I think one of our most powerful attributes as an institute is our ability to combine disciplinary expertise. So that means that our functionality fundamentally is really at the level of the team, not at the level of the individual. And diversity is a critical feature of team capacity, team ability and performance. Successful research teams must contain a diversity of people, recognising that these people bring strengths in very different ways. I mean, here in this institute, we see really exceptional researchers come in very different forms and contributing in very different ways. Visionaries, communicators, analysts, abstract thinkers, pragmatists, enablers, introverts, extroverts. They can be confident or self-depreciating. They can be seekers of the limelight or the shadows. You can't have an institute full of leaders. It would be ego-laden and a difficult and unpleasant place to work in. I did quite a lot of that as a postdoc. We need to maintain a staff profile that's balanced and can use all of our talents, the full range of talents, in all its different guises. And for me, I think this one is a useful process for getting us to that point. It isn't some horrendous administrative hoop we have to jump through. It actually helps to formalise that process and get us to where we want to go.
I think that's the perfect point at which to end. Can I thank the people around the table for their contributions? Thank Hannah for her help co-presenting. And can I thank you all for listening?
Thanks for listening to the Naturally Speaking podcast. If you've got any ideas for future shows or want to get involved, then please contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is naturallyspeakingpodcast@gmail.com. Naturally Speaking is a podcast from the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine at the University of Glasgow. For more information, you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at the NS Podcast. And you can download future episodes and find more information at our blog at naturallyspeakingpodcast.wordpress.com.